Hey, it's the Bon Appetit Foodcast, and I am Adam Rappaport. First up this week, Carla Lolly Music, talking about her favorite dessert, galettes. She wrote a beautiful story in the September issue on this all-purpose dessert. It includes a fail-proof dough that you can fill with literally anything. Well, not literally anything, but all sorts of things, be it end-of-summer stone fruit, berries, or fall pears and apples. Carla is a master, and she schools me on how to do it right. After that, we are kicking off a new podcast mini-series. We are having a different member of our test kitchen come in each week for the next several weeks to do a lightning round of their personal top 10 cooking rules. First up, the one and only Brad Leone. But now, let's get to the show. Here is Carla Lolly Music. Okay, here is my galette pitch. Are you ready for it?
Ready.
It's not fruit pie, it's fruit pizza.
Hey.
How do you like that?
I just don't think you need to like try to make pie sound more appealing. Do you know what I mean?
I'm not a big fruit pie fan.
Eating or making?
Either.
Okay.
The reason I love galettes and I love your story in the new September issue of Bon Appetit, yes, you can galette that. I love the proportions of a good galette. It's like it feels to me it's equal parts buttery, flaky, touch salty, crackly, crisp crust with sort of syrupy, ripe fruit.
Yeah.
My issue with fruit pie, like a blueberry pie that I've seen, I don't actually eat them. I just see them.
Okay.
There's just so much of that gloppy blueberry with the crust, and it's like you can literally serve them in a bowl, and like the proportions, it's just too much glop to not enough crisp.
See, so my argument for a galette is I just think pies are much harder to do well. So everything that you're saying, I don't necessarily disagree with what you're saying. And I think part of the artistry of pie making is figuring out how to get the filling so that you do get the clean slice and the whole thing doesn't run out all over the plate and that the top crust like doesn't get too steamy on the underside, but the bottom crust doesn't sog out. Like there's a whole, it's complicated.
There is, not to mention, if we want to get into the whole world of like crimping and latticing.
Oh, I'm terrible at crimping. So that's where a lot of my like galette attachment came from. Every time I made a pie, I would get the slump. I have had many conversations with Claire Savitz and Chris Morocco, like, what the hell? Every time I make it, it's like up on the edge of the pie rim and then it just wants to slide downtown. And they were like, you might be doing this, you might be doing that, you might be doing the other thing. The thing with a galette is like all you need to be able to make a dough and mound a fruit and then some casual folding.
Yeah, you know what, Carla? You've got a husband, you've got two teenage boys, basically. One teenage, one's coming. You got a full-time job.
I got a tween, which might be worse than a teen. I don't know.
You've got enough other things to worry about than slumping and latticing and crimping.
Can't do it.
Just make something delicious and rustic.
Exactly. And then I will say, I don't dislike pie, but I just like it better when somebody else makes it. Mm. But the part of the galette where it's folded over, so you do get top and bottom crust.
So the crust part where you lay like, the fruit in, then you crimp over the edges.
Like if we go back to our pizza, you know, analogy.
It's like the crust.
Like the crust.
Yeah, the crust.
That is kind of the best part. Because that's you get that sugary top crust part.
Mm-hmm. So I'm looking at a photo in the September issue of Bon Appetit. You can subscribe at bonappetit.com/get the mag. Please do. We will hugely appreciate it. bonappetit.com/get the mag.
Yeah, we're actually making a magazine over here.
I know, we still do. All right, so this gorgeous shot of on the left, an uncooked crust kind of like folded into itself. And in the middle is this beautiful mound of glazy, I would say uncooked crust with uncooked peaches and plums.
Correct.
And then on the right, it's all baked and golden brown and flaky, and there's a little scoop of ice cream in the middle. Should we start with the crust? Because this was the part of the process. I've made galettes before. I've definitely made apple ones before around Thanksgiving. I don't know what I'm doing when it comes to crust. You seem to have very particular thoughts when it comes to getting that buttery, flaky crust.
Yeah, so I worked on this particular method for a butter crust when I first heard about it many years ago, and it was on an episode of remember when Julia Child would do like Julia Child and Master Chefs? It was like Julia Child and a chef. And she was on with Jim Dodge, who's kind of a legendary pastry chef and cookbook author. And he was making apple pie with her. And he did this crazy method where instead of rubbing the butter and flour together or cutting it together with or pulsing it with your fingertips or doing it in the food processor, which is like what I grew up watching my mom do, he rolled the butter into the flour. So he just like tossed it all together, the big pieces of butter, all-purpose flour, a little bit of sugar, the salt. So the same thing that you would normally put into your food processor and pulse. He just dumped them out and then just got out a rolling pin and started rolling everything together. And I was like, well, that's crazy. I've never seen anything like that in my life. And then I tried making a crust that way, and it was incredibly flaky. So I've just been tinkering with this method for years now, and I ended up really getting into it when I wrote my book. And the version in the magazine is a further adaptation of the one that I did in the book, where I you just keep tweaking the proportions and messing around with it.
So there's a, first of all, there's step-by-step photos, which helps immensely when you're with baking and also trying to explain a new technique to someone.
Yeah.
It says you've got the sugar, salt, 1.5 cups flour, and then you cut the butter, and it's basically 3/4 cup, which is 1.5 sticks, into 6 rectangular pieces. When you say rectangular, does that mean we're going lengthwise?
Yeah. So what I normally do is you have, so it's a stick and a half of butter. So then cut the full stick in half at the 4 tablespoon mark. So you have like...
Yep.
The same, and then cut each of those in half.
Oh, clever.
Top to bottom, and then you end up with like rectangular planks.
Okay, and then you're rolling the, you toss them in the flour and that mixture, and then you start rolling them out, and what you're left with, as I see in the step-by-step, which is nice, are these long sort of strips that are kind of hanging out together, but still kind of separate.
Yeah.
And you're scraping them all up with the scraper into a pile, and at that point you start adding the ice cold water.
Right. So the advantage of this is, one, you don't need a food processor. So I really like that it's like minimal equipment. I'm pretty sure I demoed this technique for the dough in the naked apple tart video, which is also online. So you can kind of see me do it on that. But you end up with sheets of butter that are tossed into the flour, and you don't need a food processor to get it down to side. And then if you are, you know, using your hands, I think a lot of people overwork the butter, get it too small, and that can lead to problems where you don't get your flaky bits. And so it's just sort of mimicking what you want in the end, which is sheets of butter threaded throughout the flour. Because what happens in the oven is when the butter starts to melt with the heat of the oven, it releases steam, and the steam helps open up these air pockets.
And that gives you flakiness.
So instead of flakiness, which is really like round pockets here and there, when you have sheets, flat sheets of butter, you get like a lot of more like puff pastry, thin layers sort of throughout.
I'm always a little, the times I've made pie dough, not a big baker, when you start to add the cold water, I'm like, well, I don't want to add too much because then it's going to get gummy or doughy or whatever, but I don't want to. If I add too little, it's not going to come together. What is your rule of thumb in terms of with this type of crust?
There's a measured amount of ice water. I think one thing that has helped me has been to use a larger measuring cup than what I actually need the amount of ice water, and just make a big like measuring cup filled with ice water and then measure out of that instead of trying to put in ice cubes.
When you say ice water, you mean literally have ice cubes in that
water.
Correct.
So I'll take like a 2-cup measure and fill that with ice and water, so the water is like really freezing cold, and then you can just measure from that.
Question.
Yes.
Let's say you're making this pie galette crust on a day like today. It's now August like 20th or something. It's kind of humid out and hot and
it's
muggy.
It's August heat wave. I don't know what day it is.
Does that affect the amount of water you add or how the crust comes together?
I think hypothetically, yes. And I think that very nuanced bread bakers are going to notice, you know, humidity. I think the bigger factor is actually the temperature of your kitchen and how fast your butter is going to melt on a hot day.
Okay. Yeah.
So like,
do you have the AC cranking or not?
Yeah, I don't have AC in my kitchen, so I'm not going to do a ton of butter work.
So you've got this rolled out crust. put it in the fridge to rest for a little bit once you roll it out.
Yeah.
All purpose. You can kind of put any type of fruit you want in here. What is, in terms of, do you have a favorite type of fruit, or what are some basic pointers in terms of how much fruit to add? I also noticed like cornstarch in some of these. What's the deal with cornstarch, but not all of them?
Yep.
Help me out here.
So you can use any fruit, and that's how I developed the recipe, so that the temperature of the oven doesn't change, the quantity of the dough doesn't change, and the weight of the fruit doesn't change.
So 400 degrees.
Is it?
It is. It says 400 degrees right there on every single recipe. You should know this.
I should, but do we drop the fruit right
then
away?
Place
yeah, you drop
in
it to 375.
What's up with that?
So the reason that I did that is because when you open the oven, you lose like 50 degrees right off the bat. So
Do you really?
I've done this with digital thermometers.
Oh,
you really do. And it's like kind of shocking. So I start at 400 just to make sure that when it goes in, it's closer to the actual target temperature, which is 375.
Okay, I like that. That probably helps the bottom get crispy.
Yeah, and it helps the top get the nice browning too. And it helps with like, you know, slumping and sweating and stuff. So the amount of fruit is the same in all of them. It's 2 pounds total. But I did divide things up. So there's a berry version, there's a stone fruit version, and then there's the fall fruit. In the fall fruit, it's apples and or pears. You can combine those. You could do half and half or whatever. You could do all apple or all pear.
And we've talked about how certain apples are better for baking than others.
Yeah.
They hold their shape better, et
cetera. Right. We like pink ladies.
Yep.
They're great. Apples and pears also have their own natural pectin, which helps them, and they don't like juice out the way a berry does.
Interesting.
So that's why that one does not have any cornstarch in it, because you just don't need it. They're just not like releasing that much liquid, and so it's unnecessary.
I like how in the photo for the fall fruit galette, you left the red and green skin on the apples and pears. You've got this beautiful sort of red-green ombre situation happening.
So that was another thing that I kind of discovered by accident. I was making a different galette, a legendary galette in Bon Appetit, Allison Roman, salted butter, maple whipped cream, apple galette from our November issue of several years ago.
Like 2013 or 12.
Yeah, which I had made a bunch of times. And then one time I made it and I just forgot to peel the apples. Like the recipe said to peel them, and I just like straight up didn't do it.
You should have a YouTube show. Your next YouTube show should just be called Carla Music, the Lazy Baker.
Right. Just like, oh, I forgot to.
Yeah. I like rustic desserts.
Yeah. And like, as I was shingling them, I was like, oh, yeah, I was definitely supposed to peel those apples. And like, I'm definitely not going to now. And it was fine.
When you're eating them, they don't get like papery or anything or
not
stuck
really.
In your teeth?
No,
it's fine. It looks prettier
and
this
way. And I feel
way.
Like, you know, I'm a little inspired by, I don't know if these are true stories, but stories of like French, you know, dessert chefs who would like leave the cherry pits and the cherry clafoutis and just be like, that's your problem.
Yeah.
So I'm like, I like the way it looks too. And it also gives flavor and it protects the fruit, I think, maybe a tiny bit from drying out. I don't know.
Oh, wait. So question. So this looks great. You got the apples in the middle and there's a little cinnamon in there or anything like that in terms of
this one
flavor?
Has fennel seeds.
Fennel seeds.
Yeah.
Ooh, nice. That's kind of like sometimes in that sort of German apples and cabbage and fennel seeds.
Exactly.
Sort of deal. I like that.
There's something like savory and sweet about it. And I tried the first version of it. I really wanted to use coriander. So I used like whole coriander seed, like going for that. You know how the coriander seed is like lemony and very bright. And I thought that would be nice with the apple in kind of a chutney-ish way.
Yeah, yeah.
And you just couldn't taste it. Like for the amount of coriander seed that you had to add. So I switched to fennel and it worked. These are optional. You don't have to add the fennel seed if that doesn't sound appealing to you. But there's something really nice about it. It's a little different.
I like the sound of it.
Yeah.
Sounds like also you think about sausage and apple sometimes.
Sure.
Fennel seeds and sausage. You mentioned also some sort of like some elements to hop it up your galette. It could be fennel seeds, could be coriander. You know, it's about lemon zest or lime zest in there. It's just a nice way to sort of brighten the fruit a little bit.
Yeah. So I played around with each of these having a dry spice element to them. And then all of them have an acidic element, which you always need when you're making a pie filling or galette filling, something to offset the sweetness and enhance the sweetness really of the fruit. So whether it's apple cider vinegar in one or lemon juice in another, they're semi-interchangeable. You just have to think about including it, and then you could play around. Like I feel like that the apple one could totally work with lime juice. And
but then, but the zest adds a more of a
aromatic,
fragrance, aromatic, and you mix that in with the sugar.
For sure. Yes. Yeah. Mix that in with the sugar.
Heat is interesting. You also talk about whether a black pepper is something like, you, if you're going to Italy, they'll sometimes serve strawberries with black pepper and balsamic and
stuff.
And you recommended that for your strawberry one?
Yes.
Yeah.
I really like it. I like the little bit of heat that you get from it. But again, if you wanted to try messing around with like a pinch of cayenne, that could be cool too. I tried using tagine in the plum one and it didn't quite work out because I wanted all of the quantities to stay the same for this story. And the amount of tagine you need to use would be like more.
Ah,
but
gotcha.
You could kind of get into your spice cabinet and think about
Another question. So when you guys in the test kitchen are developing recipes, every afternoon you have tastings and you set these things out and invite some editors down to taste them. What sort of response or criticism or sort of enthusiasm did you get from the editors when introducing things like black pepper or fennel seeds?
Yeah, people were into it. The biggest... The biggest thing we talk about is like, if you're going to add something that's unexpected or unusual, it needs to be worth it. Mm. So with the coriander, like we just couldn't taste it. So then I was like, well, what's the point? Yeah. I'm telling someone to like crush coriander seeds and it's like, you're not even going to really get it. The biggest feedback I got was that the galettes needed more sugar. So
sugar while
in the fruit
with
filling.
The fruit.
Oh. Yeah, the sugar in the pie dough is really minimal. And if you increase sugar too much, you get bad things start to happen. I don't understand the science of it, but like when you add a very sweet butter crust will become very hard to work with. Yeah. Temperamental and very delicate. So that wasn't the issue. The issue was I was like barely using any sugar to toss the fruit with, and in my book I don't use any.
What?
And I realized,
is it too late to change that?
No, apparently it is. And I like, it's so funny because I made,
because it's already printed,
and people are making those galettes and seem to be enjoying them. But and it was an intentional decision and a personal decision then, because I like the idea of the fruit kind of just being the fruit, you know. Mm-hmm. And like, it bakes for a long time and it softens a lot and it changes, and the fruits were interchangeable also. But when I started working on the galette for BA, it's a totally different scenario, like you said, where I'm in the test kitchen with all my comrades. We're like tasting each other's food. We're talking about it. And everybody was like, you have to put more sugar. And I was like, do I though? And it was like, yeah, yes, you do. So the sugar, every time we did the tasting, like it kept going up and up and up. And we ended up at a third of a cup, which I think a lot of recipes you look at are like half a cup or more. So it's still minimal. Like you're still getting mostly the natural sweetness of the fruit. And that's just, I think, for me, a personal preference. I don't like super sweet pie fillings like that. What you were describing at the beginning, it's always, they're so sweet and
like
syrupy. And
but it's crazy. I mean, you've made like jam before. It's insane the amount of sugar that jam recipes call for.
Insane.
Yeah. You're like, wait, what? How much of my sugar am I putting in this
pot? Sugar?
Yeah. I did that demo at Outside Lands a few weeks ago in San Francisco with Jessica Koslow from Squirrel, and she's famous for her the Squirrel jams from a restaurant in LA. And I was like, I don't want to say I was appalled, but I was like eyes wide open. I was like, holy cow, the amount of sugar going in that pot.
It's at least equal in weight, right?
It's a lot.
And sometimes it's more sugar than by weight than the fruit.
Speaking of sugar, however, so you have a mostly savory, buttery, slightly salty crust, which I love. One thing you do when you fold it over on the edges, first you brush it with heavy cream.
Yeah.
What's the difference between heavy cream and egg wash as far as a wash? Does it matter?
Either one would work. I used heavy cream because I'm assuming you might be serving with whipped cream.
Mm, you better.
So having an egg and then having... Yeah. So I just went with cream because it just seemed to one fewer ingredient.
But then what I like is that you then, after you fold it over, after you brush it with cream, you sprinkle sugar on that folded over crust.
And you could use sugar in the raw for that. You could use granulated sugar. You could use
sanding
sugar.
I like that because you get a little bit of a crunch and a little glistening
Sort
of element.
I think actually that the plain granulated sugar might be my favorite in terms of what it like turns into, just that like ice cracky layer on top.
Yep.
That might be sugar in the raw. You could do nothing, which is also I made sure and tested with just the cream wash, but not a crunchy, and I definitely prefer it with the sugar. But
well, this is funny because I'm looking at the apple one, apple pear. This definitely looks like sugar in the raw or turbinado or whatever. And then the one on the opener, the peach plum.
Yeah, that's just granulated.
Granular, yeah, and it gets more sort of like that sort of flaky, glazy sort of situation.
Yeah, like it's starting to caramelize. And then I think on the strawberry one on the first page on that cool plate didn't have anything.
No,
so we showed it all of the ways.
Can we talk about the strawberry?
Yeah, please. Wow. Now I'm scared.
I'm kind of calling BS on cooked strawberries, baked strawberries. They have a strange mucilaginous texture when heat is applied to them. They get kind of slippery and a little gooey.
Okay.
That's my issue with strawberries. I love strawberries.
Yeah.
I just don't know if I need them in a pie or galette.
Okay.
Just throwing it out there.
Heard. Know? Then you might be more interested in one of the other berries for the any berry.
So I could use blueberries on this.
You could.
Yeah.
And you could use blackberries and currants if you wanted to.
We had that blueberry galette on the BA cover. And what year was that? Like 12?
A bunch of
12
years.
12 or 13 with the melting ice cream and the hand-done type lettering. That was
really pretty. Yeah, so that had a pecan. There was some ground pecan in that crust.
Oh.
I remember that. That was a good crust too. So I will say this about the crust. The technique for making the crust might be one you haven't tried before. What has worked for me, and judging by also engaging with people who have tried it from the naked apple tart that I did and from the book, the thing with making crusts is like the first time you do it is the first time you do it. Yep. And it's going to be like the just getting our feet wet.
It's like the first pancake.
It's the first pancake. And the key for me was finding a technique that like made sense, that felt natural to me, that kind of came together quickly.
Also,
and in the repetition is where you're like really start to be familiar, you know, and then that some of that confidence. So you were saying like, how do I know about the water? When is too much? When is not enough? I try to give like enough visual cues so people would know whether they needed a little more water. But again, you'll like learn as you go.
What I like about this crust, interesting technique that yields delicious results, but with super basic ingredients you always have in your house.
Right.
1.5 teaspoons sugar, 3/4 teaspoon kosher salt, 1 1/3 cups all-purpose flour, and 3/4 cups, 1.5 sticks of chilled unsalted butter.
Right. Like
that's it. And a little bit of water.
And most butter crusts, like that's all they are ever.
Yeah.
There's not like a ton of variation in terms of, some recipes might tell you to put in vodka. There might be slight variations in the fat to flour ratio, but it's really like how it comes together. And for me, this like, it just worked really well the first time I did it. And then I was like, okay, well then I'm going to like sort of weed out all the other ways of doing it and just do this from now on.
So before you put your beautiful galette in the 400 degree oven, you do it like to do it on a sheet tray with parchment on underneath?
Yeah, rim baking sheet lined with parchment.
Oh, because it's going to ooze.
There's definitely going to be leakage.
Yeah.
Just accept it.
Leakage. So you want to have that rim so it doesn't end up burning on the bottom of your oven.
Correct. And the parchment just really helps you detach it from the baking sheet and also with cleanup.
I was going to ask if you
don't use wax paper.
Okay, don't do that. And I was going to ask if you ever do it on a pizza stone, but that would not be smart because that would ooze. And pizza stones are
you might get some overflow on the pizza stone.
Don't want that.
So you roll out the dough and then you put it right onto the parchment on the baking sheet. So I've made this mistake too where I roll out the dough and I'm like so into it. And then I'm like mounding the fruit up and I'm folding it. And then I finish and I'm like, cool. So now I have to lift like an assembled galette off of the counter onto the there's no spatula in the world big enough.
a pizza peel but if you don't have that
it's really annoying when you do that. So just get it on the parchment. You could lift it from the parchment onto the rim baking sheet, but it's just easier to assemble everything and then you go right into that 400 degree oven.
Final question before we go, what's your preference for serving them? Do you like them, if you're having friends over, do you like them to be in the oven during dinner so it comes out pretty warm, you can smell them, or do you make them early in the day and you know what I mean? Or do you ever rewarm them?
You can rewarm them and I tested that too. So like it was like 20 minutes at 350 and the crust comes back to life. I don't really like to have the oven on when people come over because it's just hot and then it smells like dessert when you're having dinner.
Also you're like, oh shoot, the I forgot about the galette.
I forgot the galette. Takes longer than you thought, then you're like holding up dessert. Mm. So my ideal would be like the late afternoon that this is done.
You know what's also nice?
Breakfast?
Well, galette? No, but when people, like when they come over for dinner, they see the galette on the kitchen counter, like, ooh.
You did that?
Wow. Can't wait till dessert.
And then you can just be like, oh, that's nothing. No,
you should be like, oh, no, that's for tomorrow. Some friends are coming over for brunch.
That's right.
Sorry. I've got some Haagen-Dazs in the freezer for you.
You guys didn't bring dessert? Weird.
I thought I texted you. Carl Music, thanks so much. Yes, You Can Galette That is in the September issue of Bon Appetit, right?
Yeah.
Thanks.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Brad Leone, welcome back to the pod.
Yes, sir. Thank you for having me.
Okay, so here's what we're doing. On each of the next several episodes, we're going to have a different test kitchen editor on, and we're going to run through his or her top 10 cooking rules. You're up first.
I love it. Lay it on me.
All right. Your first rule. I like this one because it's something I don't know how to do. Learn to sharpen your knives.
Yeah, I mean, I live by that. A, it's very rewarding to do. But also, if you have a good knife or even a bad one, which is a great one to learn on, there's a lot of drop-off services, places you can go and bring. And some of them might do a good job. The drop-off, your knife, they'll sharpen it. A lot of them just run them on very aggressive and then find belt grinders and just remove a ton of material. Hmm. Like I would, you can get a knife, a good knife destroyed at a not great knife sharpening place. So just invest in a little whetstone, take care of your knife, and you should be able to pass it on for generations.
And now can I learn to do this on YouTube? What's the best way to learn how, like, the proper angle and motion and all that? Because I've seen you do it in the test kitchen. It's mesmerizing. The water's running. You're scraping. And yeah. I've brought my knives in a few times, and I take them home. And it's so cliche to say, but like they feel like they're brand new.
Right, absolutely. And it doesn't take much. A great way to learn. I mean, sure, you can go books, but this day and age, the internet, YouTube, it's really, you can learn just about doing anything.
Okay, related to that, this is also a good piece of advice. I don't know how to sharpen, but I have done this first one. Buy a good knife.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, that ties right into with the knife sharpening, but you know, it's an extension of your arm. And in cooking, a good knife, a good chef's knife, is something that you're going to use over and over. And if you take care of it properly and sharpen it correctly, it could last for lifetimes. Yeah. And it'll make cooking easier. It's safer. You're not fighting. You're not pushing. You should just be gliding through what you're cutting.
A couple thoughts on this. When I was like really young, moved to New York, working at the James Beard Foundation, like I was very enamored, like French chefs, and I like, got some 10-inch cooking chef's knife. 10 inch is way too big.
Like, it's a monster.
I feel like 8-inch is like the sort of the comfort zone for most people. I bought my wife Simone a 6-inch knife, which she loves, and I find myself using a lot. Yep. But I think 8-inch is max for an all-purpose knife. Yes,
I think so. I mean, it depends what you're doing. I mean, a big 10-inch like lobster splitter or something. Okay. Like it's very French, you know. Or a slicer can tend to be a little longer.
But if you can have one all-purpose chef's knife,
I vote 8-inch.
Okay. Oh, something that's which you will use your knife on, buy wild salmon.
Yeah. So there's a lot. I mean, people love salmon. It's probably one of the most consumed fish in the world, I'm guessing. But there's a lot of farmed ones, and they're not all created equal. In fact, there's a lot of them that are kind of farmed poorly, and maybe they're not fed the best things, or you know, different antibiotics, and they have their side effects. You know, when you harness that many fish in a pen, you still, even in it's when it's done some of the best ways, there's still some very harmful side effects to the ocean and the waters that they're in. I'm just a big supporting healthy fisheries that have good practices and fishing habits. like Alaskan. I love Alaskan salmon, and you know, they work hard to keep it strong. They work hard to keep people and influences that are harming it out. And it's just a much healthier product. You see it sometimes. It's leaner and the color is brighter, and it's doing what it. It's being a salmon. It's doing what its whole life, what it is meant to do. And I think it's just a healthier, not only for us consuming it, but for the planet.
What's your favorite type of wild salmon? That's like for the most, just the biggest delish factor.
So there's a type of fish up there. They call it chum salmon. Mm-hmm. The name, they need to remarket that because it sounds horrible. But a friend of mine up in outside of Juneau sent me a side of chum salmon, and it blew me away. The fat content, it was almost like king. And there was something really special there. But I love sockeye. I like coho. Honestly, I kind of love them all. A good, you know, wild king salmon. It'll cost you $50 a pound some places. But
I figure we could have a whole pot on this. But one last question: how seasonal is wild salmon?
Ooh, good question. Well, the thing is, it freezes well. So okay. I don't know the exact season. Some, of course, it's kind of like it's not very large.
Yeah.
But when they get them, they freeze really well, and if they handle them correctly and bleed them out nice. Most of the stuff you get anyway is frozen. It's hard to get. Not
exactly.
You know, yeah.
Bleed them out. Nice. Shifting gears. See, this is one I feel like I practice half of this, but not the other half. Use good vinegars and oil. I feel like we, in this sort of like this Mediterranean age of the last 30 years in America, we all buy a good extra virgin olive oil. And we're told about, we get so much preaching on extra virgin olive oil. We know about that. I feel then I just go to the grocery store and buy the random red wine vinegar.
Right. Well, back to the olive oil point, and there's a lot less options of good vinegar. The market has grown a bit in the United States, where really good olive oils are found. You can get them in supermarkets, you know.
Yeah.
But you go looking for a really good wine or really good vinegar, there isn't a lot there. There's a few, but you kind of have to know what you're looking for. That's the beauty of the internet too. You can order right from the maker.
What are your favorite vinegars to use for cooking?
I mean, there's that one out in California. I believe it's in the Napa Valley. Cats. That's a test kitchen fave.
Yeah, Cats is also a favorite of Josh McFadden, chef at Ava Jean's out in Portland, who's I would say is kind of the salad maestro these days, and just amazing things with salads and raw veg.
They make a few, and it'll once you do get some good vinegars, it's hard to go back. You'd be like, how did I do this?
Exactly.
Without it?
It's just so bright and
it
fresh.
It just elevates it. And compared to like just a generic kind of run-of-the-mill vinegar, it's like A and Z.
Yeah. And that's Katz. Not like the musical, but K-A-T-Z.
Right. Like the deli.
Thank you. Oh, see, this is like something I worry that my mom never did in the 70s. no shade to Maxine, but refresh your spices.
Oh, God. So many spices die in spice cabinets.
Like a slow death.
A slow decades of death, of just oxidation and drying out. And you're losing that beautiful color and also that aroma and flavor. I mean, perfect example, bay leaves. People hate bay leaves.
Don't get me started.
I just did. Well, some of them, they're left in there for, you know, my mom. Oh, go get a bay leaf. It's been in there for 25 years. You touch it, it turns to powder.
Yeah, it just shatters.
Yeah, or like a nice a chili flake.
I bet she still has dried marjoram in her spice jar from when she moved from Washington, D.C. like 15 years ago.
100%. I mean, smell them, look at them. If they look bad, you don't want to just go tainting your food with something that, you know. If it's bad, get rid of it. Get a new one. You'll thank yourself.
And I imagine part of the lesson there is to always buy it in smaller quantities.
You read my mind. I was going to say, don't go buy, unless you like are running a restaurant or using an insane amount of Aleppo pepper or something, buy in a small quantity. That makes, you know, so it doesn't just sit and die in the cabinet.
All right, Brad, this one seems really, I don't know if it's obvious. It's pretty broad, but I'm going to let you have this one. And also, this is maybe I'm guilty on the first half. Try new recipes and foods.
Yeah, I mean, it's easy to say. It's kind of cliche, but, you know, for a reason, I'm assuming. You got to break out of your comfort zone a little. You know, it's
your
easy
routine, to... Your weeknight routine.
Exactly. We're all guilty of it. You know, we cook the same handful of things for weeknight dinners.
Because you know it works.
Because you know it works. You know how to do it. It's tasty, yada, yada. The kids like it. The list goes on. You know, but if, you know, through different restaurants or different ideas, pull inspiration. And if you just tweak things or try things, you know, it doesn't have to be some big crazy, you know, recipe or dish. But, you know, I think it's important to, the takeaway there is to just step out of your comfort zone and try new things.
All right. This one intrigues me because I don't think I do it. season your beverages.
Oh, it's the next big thing, Rappo. everyone's always screaming, season your salad. That was a big thing for a while, and also very true. We season everything. Salt is, it brings out flavor.
Chocolate chip cookies now. Everyone's got to have salt on their chocolate chip
cookies. We salt everything. Yeah. Why does no one salt their drinks except for me and probably a million other people? But, you know, anything from a lemonade to a cocktail to just a little pinch of salt.
Just a pinch.
Just a little pinch. That's it. You know, it's an essential mineral. Or if you're like, if you're doing something, you know, if you stayed up, you know, or if you went out to dinner and maybe you and your friends had a little bit too much wine, you know, it's a type of electrolyte. So it's just going to add, and, you know, not like, you know, not a crazy amount, just a pinch. And it kind of, it'll bring out, especially like in a lemonade, a lightly salted lemonade or like a Arnold Palmer. You know, and it just, all it does is, just like in food, it's just going to bring out any flavors that are in that drink.
Also, I mean, it's interesting. It's so obvious that we don't think about something like this, but you think about like a margarita. Would you like salt with that?
Delicious.
Yeah,
makes
you're right.
That lime pop, makes the sugar pop.
All right, Brad Leone. All right, we got a couple more. Hold on. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. You got 3 more, Brad.
That's it. Did my homework.
All right.
For once.
Take notes. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so I mean, I'm speaking on for myself here, but like sometimes you're cooking, it's kind of like art, it's kind of like painting or something like that. You get into it, you kind of forget. I use the word loosely, but you like black out. You know, it's like
you're pretty loose. How much are you drinking while you're cooking?
Yeah, I mean, like you're cooking, and all of a sudden it's like you grab some of this, and like, oh, that seems like a great idea. Throw that in there. All of a sudden you sit down and you have this beautiful dinner, and it's hard to recall everything that you put in it. So I like to keep a little notebook. If I'm getting into something that isn't going to be very easy, I just make a little note. It's almost like a little doctor's notes of recipe.
So you have
building.
An actual little journal that you keep
in
that
the
in the kitchen?
Yeah.
So like, oh, added maple syrup to this marinade, whatever. It was great.
Or if I'm getting excited, like, oh, it's Saturday, I'm making short ribs, and like, maybe I don't even have a plan yet, you know, just, but I'm starting to brown them. I don't know. Then I start getting excited. Then I start getting into the dish that I'm making. And this is maybe something I'm going to want to recreate again.
Yeah.
Just some notes. And again, you might want to tweak it a little differently, but at least you know what you did so you can recreate.
And I've been guilty of that sometimes where I'm like, all of a sudden, like 2 years later, something will jog my memory. Like, oh yeah, there was that time
where I
added this to that. Why haven't I done that since?
Because
I blacked out because I had too much red wine and forgot about that thing I made. I like that one. All right. So I have a little kitchen journal.
Yeah.
Which is more fun than like using your notes app on your phone.
Yeah. And it doesn't have to be, you know, you don't even have to write down. It's just little notes. It's not like you don't have to develop a recipe.
Second to last one, prep for parties / dinner.
Yeah. All right. So, you know, I'm sure you've had people over for dinner or whatever. And, you know, as a guest show, it's to have a game plan. It's kind of like Thanksgiving. You want to have as much done as you can beforehand.
Yeah.
You know, you season your meat, your big steak or whatever. Or if you're making a side, you're going to make potato salad. Have the potatoes made. Have the potatoes boiled already.
Yeah.
Things like that. Or even have the whole thing done already. As much do as head that you can and plan. So that way, when you are there, it's, you can actually kind of enjoy yourself a little.
Okay. See, I'm...
You're still going to be stressed.
No. But I feel like sometimes I've over-prepped because I'm the type who likes to be organized and have everything crossed off. So then when people show up, you're like, okay, should we eat? Whereas like there's always those like really kind of cool Alice Waters type people who are just like, oh, let's just hang out in the kitchen while I chop some of this and season that. And hey, try this. Can you help me out? And like they make the sort of the process of cooking seem so laid back. But I guess they've done a lot of the prep work, so everything's cleaned and boiled or whatever ahead of time.
I love that idea. I love bringing people together in the kitchen, especially at a party or dinner, you know. But having your stuff set up, your mise en place, your game plan, it makes sharing, doing your Alice Waters kind of cooking experience a little easier.
But yeah, get some of the dirty work out of the way. Like, you know what? We were talking about this earlier. You know what you guys don't want to do? They don't want to clean and devein shrimp.
Right. No, that should be done.
That should be done. And maybe they want to put the shrimp on skewers. That's fine. But they don't want to like do that whole sort of...
perfect example. Yeah.
All right. Last one. Ready, Brad?
I am so ready.
Simplicity.
Yes. Simplicity. Less is more. All right. Example. You went out and you bought $100 blah, blah, blah ribeye or a nice piece of fish. Why go covering it up with, you know, it's easy and maybe you like it, to each their own, but like go covering it up with some store-bought bottle of teriyaki sauce, you know, or something, time and a place, whatever. I'm not judging anyone here. But if you're spending some money on really good things, I like to just use like a little bit of salt, a little bit of olive oil, and I want to taste that thing. I want to appreciate the ingredient that I am cooking with and consuming, especially when it's something, you know, it could be as simple as a Japanese eggplant or, you know, a giant piece of halibut.
Yeah.
For me, I like to showcase what makes that ingredient special, and covering it up with a bunch of, you name it, sometimes isn't the move.
No, just maybe it's a little bit of seasoning, a brush of a simple glaze or something.
Exactly.
But especially with protein, if you're going to spend the money, whether it's fish or pork chop or meat or whatever, appreciate that, because it should be, if it's that good, enjoy it.
And like the moral of that rule of mine, and I forget the chef that told it to me, oddly, but it always sticks with me, especially when I'm developing recipes or even just cooking on my own, is that the less is more. You know, like, you have 8 things, can you do it with 6?
Yeah.
You know, it's something like that, where it's easy to just keep adding things, trying to make it something special, but a lot of the times it doesn't need it.
Brad Leonard, you've got 10 rules, and we're sticking with them. Thanks, man.
Thank you.
The Bon Appetit Foodcast is produced by Carrie Polis and Christina Che, and produced and edited by Emma Wortsman. Our theme music is by Nathaniel Wortsman. We have new episodes every Wednesday, and if you want to tell us about this or any other episode, email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness, really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.